Elizabeth Barrett as a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Super Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Hank, you read so fast it makes me anxious. Are you in a hurry? Or are you just feeling enthusiastic?
I'm enthusiastic about today's topic.
Oh, I'm glad because I am too. I mean, I always love talking about parenting and children and how we can do our best for our families and our kids. So I'm excited about the topic too.
Grandmothering, perhaps?
Grandmothering a little bit, yes. It's still when you say it, I go, was that me?
Yeah. You don't look like a grandma. I can vouch for that.
Right now I'm looking at myself in the window between the two of us and I kind of look like a mess. But oh well.
But not a grandmother.
No. But which is, I guess, a good thing because what is a grandmother look like these days, right? Numbers, ages, they're all kind of fluid. And what does a parent look like, right? One of the things about parenting that was so overwhelming for me when my first child was born almost 30 years ago was that I had this belief, this fantasy at 24 years old, that I would carry this child for 9 months and then I would go through the labor and delivery process and the baby would be born and they'd lay her on me in this beautiful, serene environment and I would be overcome, washed over with all of the knowledge I needed to be a phenomenal parent. And so imagine my dismay when I went through 36 hours of labor and the not so easy and beautiful, you know, emergence of my child, although it was a phenomenal experience. But when they laid her on me, one, I was really hungry after 36 hours and I wasn't feeling as benevolent as I thought I would. And I never felt that wash of parental wisdom. And so that kind of set up this experience of having to learn the role and job of parenting from that point forward. It's interesting because we do a lot of preparation for the baby, right? We take classes on, we go to different childbirth classes and we talk about our birth plan. And so we talk a lot about that arrival of the baby and the care and feeding of the baby, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about the raising of the child. And I really like to refer to it more as raising of the human being, because a lot of people get excited about the idea of having a baby. You know, I can't wait to have a baby. I can't wait to be a mom. But they never really think past the idea that they're babies for a very short period of time. And then the work of raising a human being goes on for the rest of your life. Because I look at my 76-year-old mom and dad, and I still like them being my mom and dad. And so that job of parenting goes on and changes and morphs and has to be different things as our children grow from infancy to toddlerhood through adolescence into young adulthood. We as parents have to learn to grow and adapt. And although there is a lot of information out there talking about parenting and the jobs and how to talk to children or how to raise a teen, there is not a uniform consensus of really what that parenting job looks like. And so given a couple of things, I've been inspired today to talk with you about the care and feeding and raising of a human being, of what are some of the challenges and the joys of being a parent and how things have changed in the last 20 or so years that have made it really challenging for parents to feel confident in the decisions they're making or how they're raising their children. And it's interesting because my girls are 10 years apart. I've been able to raise children in two different kind of generations with two different kind of parenting expectations. And so it's been eye-opening. And now with my four-month-old granddaughter, I'm re-immersed back in that parenting world and what the fads are or the latest tips are on raising children from my daughter's perspective and what she's hearing, the feedback she's getting from pediatricians and fellow moms and kind of the pressures she's feeling to conform to the social norms of parenting. So I'm hoping we can touch on a lot of those changes. One of the things about childhood that has always perplexed me as I see how we raise children in kind of a paradoxical way. Because since the turn of probably the into the 20th century, how we looked at children, how we looked at child rearing has really changed from children as being another pair of hands on the farm or on the ranch or down in the coal mine, to children being seen as these sacred beings that come into our lives, you know, these holy creatures that we as parents have been blessed to raise. And so with that shift in how we see our children, we've shifted a lot of our ideas of how we should parent these children. And so we've made childhood in some ways this big magical bubble, right? Lots of Disneyland and fairies and cartoons and Santas and Easter bunnies and tooth fairies and protection helmets and plastic corners to all of our tables and, you know, all the ways we've tried to make it this safety bubble that will prevent our children from feeling any sort of pain and discomfort. And, you know, I understand the drive behind that. I understand the motivation. I had my first child when we started hanging placards in our car that said baby on board, as if that somehow, you know, made our car have an invisible force field around it. I get all of that. But the part that always perplexed me was that we set our children up through childhood in this magic bubble, only to pop that bubble in an incredibly painful way as they go into adolescence, into their teen years, where all of a sudden, not only are they faced with all of the biological changes, right, changes in their voice, their body, their face, their hair, but also the changes in their emotions, right, the big mood swings, the irritability, the dark feelings, the confusion, the identity search, but then also they're having all of the magic pulled out from under them, right? No more Santas, Easter bunnies, fairies, all of those things. You know, what was cute when you were five, that princess hat that was cute when you were five, is not so cute when you're 15 or 17 years old. So all of a sudden, this is an incredible crash on our teens. And so as parents, we're woefully unprepared in how to help transition not just our children from childhood into their teen years, but as parents, how do we transition from parenting children, young children, school-age children, into parenting teenagers? How do we as parents learn to go with the flow and normalize what can be called the teen storm, right, of emotions and experiences and risky behavior, all those things that are kind of normal in that experience of adolescence and is only heightened because of the changes in society, right, with the pressures for education, the pressures for activities, the pressures to be perfect. And it's not just children, but it's parents as well that feel it. So I want to explore these ideas. And fortunately, I'm not alone today. I have two guests in the studio with me today to join in the conversation. I'm actually preparing to do a workshop on childhood anxiety, and my guests are part of the Parent Connection, which is sponsoring this workshop. And so I'm feeling a little rusty, a little excited, a little anxious to get up in front of parent educators and parents again. So I'm bringing a little backup today to kind of share their perspective on what they've seen in the parenting world, some of the changes, some of the challenges. My first guest is Michelle Gordon. She is an instructor at Cuesta and Cal Poly and specializes in early childhood education and studies. She's also been a parent coach and instructor with the Parent Connection, which is a local organization here in the area, and she'll talk a little bit more about it. And my other guest is Bill Spencer, who is also a parent coach and educator for the Parent Connection in the North County, and his background is in special education as a teacher. He's also been a principal. He spent a lifetime in education, so they bring many years of wisdom. Michelle and Bill, thank you for joining the conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. We'll invite you to join the conversation in a bit at 805-781-3875. You can also find out more about the show on our Facebook page or our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. And this show, as with all of our others, will be available to podcast if you go to iTunes under The Reluctant Therapist and subscribe. Or previous shows are also available at our website, kcbx.org, under the News and Talk tab. All right, so Michelle and Bill, I'll let you decide who's going to go first. You heard what I threw out there, some of the challenge of modern-day parenting. What do you see going on out there? And maybe talk a little bit more about the Parent Connection and what you do.
I'll start with Parent Connection. So Parent Connection is a program under the Center for Family Strengthening, a local nonprofit, and we're funded through the Millionaires Tax in California, the Mental Health Services Act, which fortunately we have to fund mental health services in San Luis Obispo County. And community really decided that parent education in this county was a priority, and Parent Connection was born. So we're a web-based parent resource center, slowslparents.org. We offer a comprehensive listing of parenting resources on the website. We also offer about 35 classes, parenting classes a year, that cover South County, SLO, and North County in both English and Spanish. And lastly, we offer no-cost parent coaching. So we have Bill in the North County. I cover San Luis Obispo, and we have Jimena in the South County, who's our bilingual coach, to work with parents one-on-one to really support them in their parenting.
Wonderful. And so, Bill, how did you get involved with the Parent Connection and with this work as a parent coach? Why the need?
Well, I've been working in public schools for over 30 years, and when I retired a few years back, I got involved with the Parent Connection because I've always done parent education classes for elementary age all the way up to high school. And I enjoy helping parents because if I can help parents with their kids who are going to school, it helped their kids do better in school.
Mm-hmm. So as I'm sure being in education, you probably saw over and over again parents struggling to know what behavior is normal in their children and how to best support them. And I'm wondering if you saw what I was talking a little bit about, is this change from kind of parents expecting their kids to get up and go to school no matter what, you know, kind of a little hard line parenting to this more kind of frightened parent response of, if my child is displaying any sort of disturbing behaviors, I'm going to keep them home. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that switch?
Yeah, we call that helicopter parents.
Yes.
And where kids aren't taking responsibility like they used to. Like you said, way back in the 20th century, they worked on farms. They had a lot of responsibility. Now their responsibility is school. And if kids don't do well in school, then parents start freaking out and start getting really over-controlling. And a lot of times that backfires. When parents start trying to work with their kids and develop rules and get very stringent, kids tend to rebel, especially teenagers.
Yeah. And it is kind of that learning how to translate the parenting that might have worked really well when your children are young to adjusting as a parent when your child becomes an adolescent or a teen and has a different skill set that they have to learn. So, Michelle, what are some of the things you've seen parents struggling with through your work?
Well, I work with a really diverse group of parents. I work with teen parents who have their own set of challenges. I work with the with youth at the Grizzly Youth Academy who are parents as well, California Men's Colony. But most of my coaching is really with parents in San Luis Obispo. A number of them have teenagers. I'd say if I were to really try to consolidate the concerns into, I would say, anxiety. I'm seeing more and more parents really talking about their teens being anxious about school, social anxiety. And then I'm also hearing about depression in terms of leaving behind activities at one point that they enjoyed, things that were meaningful for them. And so the opportunity to talk with parents one-on-one about these concerns, I really appreciate. And I wanted to add, I love this analogy that Joseph Allen brings up in his book, The Endless Adolescence. I'm sort of abbreviating it there, but I can come up with it in a moment. He talks about how we've become this sort of germ-phobic society. So in the early years, you know, we have the hand sanitizer and we're, you know, rubbing it on our toddler's hands and we're, you know, washing the toys and we're trying to keep our children as germ-free as possible. And what do we have? We have high numbers of allergies and asthma. And so when they really look at this, it seems that the kids that fare best are the kids that have some animal dust or some animal fur, you know, hairs, or that their world isn't truly germ-free, and that actually children on farms do really well in terms of developing a healthy immune system. And I try to use that analogy with the parents of teens in terms of talking about these teenage experiences are like animal hairs and dust, and they allow us to build a healthy immune system to life stressors. So we get resiliency by being challenged. We get resiliency by having these setbacks, by failing, by things not working out. But I think as parents, and myself included, I have two boys, 17 and 20. We're really fearful of our boys failing, not our boys, our children failing. And mm-hmm. so we almost run ahead of them, clearing the path and making it as trouble-free as possible, so that they, you know, they can smoothly sort of make their way down it. And we really rob them of resiliency and rob them of opportunities to find their way.
You know, it's funny, and I don't remember where I read this, but someone likened the change in parenting to being part of a circus, that raising children is like being the head of a circus, and that parents today want to be at the head of the parade, right? They want to lead the circus performers, and as you said, clear the way, make sure it's set up, hang up the tent, hang up the posters, mm-hmm. yay, go children, have a parent tunnel, right? Every time the kids do something, it's like they're always leading the charge, and the kids, the circus performers never really get to kind of branch out and have their own moment in the sun, as opposed to our parents, probably, you know, a generation or two before, were the ones that came behind the circus right. and cleaned up the mess left behind by the performers and the circus animals, which is kind of a little more reactive instead of being proactive. And so I guess what I'm wondering about today is, you know, what are some of the costs to the changes in parenting we're seeing today? And what are some of the things our parents are struggling with? I'd like to open that up to our listeners because I think there's a million ways we could go with this. And I'm curious to know what parents or grandparents or people out there listening are wondering about childhood or parenting or how to best help their children. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guests are Michelle Gordon and Bill Spencer. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. 805-781-3875. And I want to say that, you know, due to recent tragedies in our community, and you know, it's difficult to talk about some of these subjects of raising children, especially when we talk about teens, because suicide is such a big concern, because mental health is such an issue. The way we talk about mental health, you know, the term mental illness is quick to be on everyone's tongue whenever a child is struggling. And so I just want to let you who are listening as a parent, this conversation might be a little challenging given what's been going on in the community. We've had some losses in the last few weeks and recently. So I think it's a very touchy subject. But I think it's also important to talk about the challenge of parenting given the shift in how we view mental health in our culture in the last 20 years from being kind of a psychic phenomenon related to what's happening in the person's life, whether it's their social life or their personal life or their parenting or family experience or what's happening economically or in their education. I mean, when we looked at mental health and I'm a therapist by training and an educator by profession, that my training was all about looking at the whole person, right? We have to look at their entire environmental experience to understand why they're behaving the way they do. And the shift I've seen, which was the birth of the show, was this move to more of a medical model, right? To look at symptoms and then grab our big book and then look up what the symptoms mean and then prescribe a treatment. That very medical model, always looking for the disease instead of the therapeutic model, which is looking at all the ways people are resilient, right? Because everyone struggles. Everyone struggles. And so how do we help people adapt to get around the struggles they have? The shift has been, and I think for a lot of parents, this pressure that when their children struggle, they're either pushed into or they believe that it always means there's some sort of pathological issue, that kids who act out or irritable or depressed or anxious, that equates to a mental disorder or a mental illness that needs to be treated. And so part of my concern and something we can't ignore is that change has changed how parents feel they have to address their children, that we run into the medical professional's office quite often against our better instinct as a parent. Like, we might guess maybe this is a normal childhood thing, but we read so much or we see so much in the news about mental illness or mental health that we tend to run in quickly. And there's a lot of very casual diagnosing that goes on. And that's not to minimize the important diagnosing of true mental illness. But remember, that's supposed to be rare, right? Those mental illnesses, such as bipolar disorder, even ADHD, are supposed to be rare 1% of the time. But we are, you know, medicating children at the rate of 14%. So I'm interested to know both of your perspectives, or if you've seen, you know, this social norm impacting how parents approach their children, or this fear, you know, that their child might become severely depressed and then commit suicide, does that prevent them from doing the work that they need to do as parents?
I have a friend who is in the mental health field. He's a psychotherapist, and he's feeling that really is a parenting issue, not a mental health issue.
Okay.
And that when they see those kinds of behaviors that exhibit, you know, depression, anxiety, rebellion, destructive kinds of behavior, parents first go, hey, how can we fix this?
Fix the behavior?
Fix the behavior, mm-hmm. Right. And so he thinks that mainly there are some things that you can do as parents to help kids get through that. And by asking, you know, good questions to let them start making decisions, problem solving together. I call it cooperative problem solving. Taking on some responsibility that sometimes as parents we want to do for our kids because we love them so much. You know, I want to help them. I want to fix it. And when that happens, it takes the responsibility off the kid. And I believe that it exacerbates the anxiety and depression in teens.
And I wonder also, again, that pressure from society telling parents, good parents, you know, if you're a good parent, you're going to rush your child and you're going to get them diagnosed. I mean, that seems to be the cultural story.
Right. I really appreciate this conversation, and certainly it resonates with me both personally and experiences I've had as a mother, and also professionally. And I really, in working with parents one-on-one, really want to listen to their concerns and challenges, but I also believe it's important very early on in the conversation to pull out the strengths, to talk about what's working, what's good about your family, what strengths does your child have, and rather than focusing on what we want to see less of, those problem behaviors, and beginning to equate the child and the problem sort of one in the same, what do we want to see more of? What do we want to build on? And sort of taking the perspective that what we focus on grows. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a way to take a teenager's strengths and use it as a vehicle for them to sort of grapple with some of the challenges that they're having and grow competence, confidence, autonomy, choice-making, self-direction through those challenges. But we need to be, I feel we need to be strength-focused in our conversations and ask, what's working? How can we build that? What are the possibilities in this situation? What are the opportunities? And not to be naive around, as you said, that there are concerns and there are challenges, and a referral certainly might be appropriate. But I think in terms of supporting the parent, really shifting from the problem to what's the opportunity.
Well, and I guess, you know, again, my reluctance in looking at all behavioral issues or mental health issues as being pathological and worthy of a diagnosis, my question always is, once you have the diagnosis or the label, then what? Right, then where do we go? Because a lot of people say, you know, the defense of the DSM or the defense of the labels is, but once we know what it is, then we'll feel better because we know why our child or why I'm struggling. But my concern with that is at some point the child's not going to want that label, right? When our children grow up, they want to be autonomous. They don't want to have things that set them apart or make them feel different or odd. I know a lot of, you know, young people with Asperger's diagnosis or autism diagnosis in the high schools who are being mainstreamed, there comes a moment of recognition around sophomore year where they realize, oh, I have this diagnosis. I have this thing that makes me different. And all you want when you're a teen is to fit, to blend. And so I often wonder the benefit of these diagnoses and labels. You know, it may make it easier for us to talk as professionals about the behaviors we're seeing. But how do you help a young person to succeed, to thrive, to feel like they can be successful if they're burdened by this, the weight of this diagnosis? I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guests are Michelle Gordon and Bill Spencer from the Parent Connection, and we invite you to be part of the conversation as well. 805-781-3875. What goes through your mind when you think about parenting or raising children? How has that experience been for you, and do you feel the pressure from culture to parent in a specific way? Bill, what do you think?
Well, just to go back, what Michelle was saying, we're talking about some of the labeling. And Michelle and I do an activity. It's called Liabilities and Assets. And we take a look at all the liabilities that parents say that they that their kids have, and we change those into more positive. So short attention span would be kid with a lot of interest. You know, a person who is rebellious, seeks challenges, you know, so we kind of look at those as a positive instead of a negative.
But so if we know we can do these things, I just keep going back to, I feel like a little bit like the three of us would be standing behind this wall of water coming our way, or the dam, right? Or like sticking our finger at the dam of, but wait a second, I understand, you know, the concern. I understand the social conversation about mental illness and depression and suicide and kids, and we should be afraid, and, you know, and we should be afraid of our children and their emotions. And, you know, even the movie Inside Out didn't help us as much in understanding the emotional fluidity of a human experience as much as I hoped it would, because I still feel this crushing onslaught of professional documentation or protocol saying if a child behaves in such a way, and I'll give you an example. When it comes to the use of bipolar disorder as a diagnosis, it's a severe psychiatric disorder that is considered, if you have that diagnosis, a lifelong chronic struggle. It's not something that you come in and out of. It's not something that you get over and move on. If you are diagnosed with this, it is a heavy diagnosis and generally is diagnosed primarily in adults because there are some very strong symptoms that need to be identified over a period of time. But what we've seen since 1999 is an increase 4,000 times the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children as was diagnosed in 1999. And 30 to 40% of those diagnoses are in teens. And the thing that's interesting is you can see a direct correlation between normal adolescent stormy behavior and the way they write the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And so the concern is, how do we know if our child is on the severely mentally ill spectrum of something like bipolar disorder, or is normally experiencing the crisis of the teen years, because it is a huge, overwhelming change, as I mentioned at the top of the show. You know, you have a child that goes from being sweet and cooperative and loving, and mom's my best friend, and dad's the best, and I love my pets, and I love soccer, and all these wonderful things, and then almost overnight, they hate everything. Right, they punch a hole in their wall. They are, you know, despondent because of a breakup. They hate the way they look. They hate the way you look. You know, it's just, it is a change. And parents will often say, "I lost my child. I've lost my child." And I think just even that idea of looking at childhood as when they start to develop into more autonomous beings, we as parents see that as a loss of the perfect child instead of embracing the next process, which is growing to independent teen. So do you ever feel that way, that we're almost holding back this wave of medical diagnosing teen life and even children's behavior, right? The normal tantrums and out-of-control behaviors that we see in children. Do we have an epidemic level of severely pathologically mentally ill children and teens, or is it a cultural thing?
Huge question.
I just threw it to you, Michelle.
And I'm a
hot potato.
Parent educator and parent coach. So I do know that when I work with parents, and I certainly feel the challenge of respecting their own anxiety around parenting and the fear. I mean, we have a lot of fear-based parenting. And I know I went
through... But what's the fear? What is the fears you're hearing parents tell you?
The fear, I think, you know, many levels. There's the fear that it's a very competitive world and my child won't match up. The fear that if my child doesn't, I mean, the fear can start early. If they don't, you know, have this experience, if they don't have these rich experiences, then they won't, you know, have meatiness enough for the college app. And if they don't have, you know, the right college app and the right resume, then so it is, I think we feel this immense pressure on that level. So there is that level. I think there's also the fear that as we're sorting through, is this typical adolescent behavior or is this something of concern? I think the enormity of being able to, of knowing that, of missing perhaps, mm-hmm. that we are charged now with being so in tune with our children that if we miss that they were struggling and somehow, you know, we read it wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think it's true. A generation ago, I mean, my husband had 5 siblings and, you know, they spent much of their time outside with mixed age groups. And so the 6-year-old was charged with taking care of the 2-year-old. And, you know, end of the day, everyone was alive and we called it good. Now is, you know, we're really charged with, are we meeting the social emotional needs of our children? And if we're not, you know, what resources can we bring to that? And I think it's a tremendous, I think there's some gifts in current parenting. There truly are. But I think there's a burden that we carry. And in some ways, by sort of diving into that, we also take on too much of the teenage years for our adolescents, and we don't give them the tools they need to problem solve.
Well, and also not to, you know, it's hard to say this without sounding like I'm being flip, and I'm not mm-hmm. being flip, but there is a little bit of that having to throw the kids out there at mm-hmm. some point and seeing if they can survive, kind of like the baby bird tossed out of the nest. Some mm-hmm. of the babies get eaten by a cat and some fly. And I mean, I think in some ways we've gotten very soft to the realities of the world, and that if we prevent our children from having those rough experiences or maybe failing or maybe getting in trouble or whatever that is, as you've been saying, and I think a lot of us know inherently, if they don't learn it now, when?
Right.
And what are the consequences of not learning it now? And I think we see that on our college campuses. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and it is a conversation. And although we're having a great time in here, we'd love to hear from you, 805-781-3875. Any questions or concerns or comments about parenting, the modern-day issues that we struggle with? And again, do you feel the pressure to be the perfect parent? Do you worry about your child's performance or their success or their mental health and well-being? You know, 90% of the children that are out on homestay at school from schools are out because of anxiety. They're not at home because of a physical illness, but they're being kept home because of things like social anxiety or test anxiety. And how then do we prepare these children who are out on homestay for anxiety to be ready for their adult life? Or are all of these parents planning on living cohabitively with their children until old age? I'm curious. I really am curious as to what the long-term plan is. Just as I'm curious about the long-term plan about diagnosing and medicating children, are you going to have them on medications for the rest of their life? At any point, will they ever be autonomous and able to figure things out on their own? 805-781-3875. My guests are Michelle Gordon and Bill Spencer. Bill, you've been patient because Michelle and I could go on and on, but what's resonating for you?
Well, I think a lot of the times we take on the responsibility that our kids should have. So, you know, waking them up in the morning, driving them to school, not holding them accountable.
At what age, though, do you think they should start waking themselves up? Because I think a lot of parents don't even know. Should it be in first grade or sixth grade? Or
you know, it really depends on the kid. But, you know, it's something that, you know, at 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, they should be getting up on their own. And so what we do is we start doing those things for them. We get them up. We make their breakfast. We make sure that they, you know, have all their homework done. And we don't let them experience the natural consequences of their behaviors.
Okay, so should we as parents, because I'm watching my sister-in-law and my sister, should we as parents be doing homework with our children? Because I feel a little pressure from teachers, some bullying into expecting parents to sit at a table at night and do homework with their children, or the parents to be responsible for their. Do you see that? That I think the schools in some ways are pressuring parents to feel like they need to be involved in their children's homework.
Absolutely.
So who is the problem? Is it the parents or is it the school saying, trying to shame parents into over parenting?
Well, the guideline for schools is, you know, 10 minutes in first grade, 20 minutes in second, 30 minutes in third, 40 minutes in fourth, and that should be it. But parents feel the pressure because they don't want their kids to fall behind. And so they'll do everything that they can. They'll do their homework for them, show them how to do it, and it gets in the way of them, of the children experiencing the natural consequences of their actions or their behaviors.
But then what if the teacher, you know, calls me up and says, well, Mrs. Barrett, you know, your daughter's homework hasn't been enough to snuff, and are you spending time going over this with her? I mean, because that's what I'm hearing from parents is I love this idea of letting my kids be free range and natural consequences. I think, you know, my daughter's generation very much felt over-parented. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm hearing from her generation is I want my kids to walk to school on their own. I want my children to experience the tough knocks. We're not going to do, you know, the over antibacterial. They're going to play in the dirt and get, you know, sick. And I hear that from my daughter's generation. She said, but at the same time, the schools are saying you should read to your child for 30 minutes a night, and we want you to check this box that you spent this time with your child doing their homework. And so, my feel for them, because they're almost, as I said, being bullied by the culture to submit to this over-parenting model.
Sure. And the kids just wants to go out and play because they've been
they
in school
oranges.
All day.
Yeah,
right. So the kid comes home, doesn't want to do his homework, not doing well in school. So what do?
Yeah.
So you have this conversation with your kid, and not at the time where there's all kinds of emotion going on.
You mean not right after school when they're
tired
and
right,
hungry?
Right, okay. Exactly. And you just notice it. Hey, Susie, I noticed that, you know, doing homework right after school is really hard for you. Yeah, I want to go out and play. You know, I understand. I really understand. I would too. Well, we've got 30 minutes of homework. What is your plan on how to do that? No, I don't know. I don't know what to do. Well, let's come up with some ideas. We come up together and see if we can find a way that will work for both of us. So you have that conversation, and then as a parent, it's your responsibility to follow through with them. Okay, instead of saying, come on, let's do your homework. What's going on? It's 4 o'clock. Yeah, so what? What did we agree upon? So you're having kids start making decisions early on. We're talking about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And so if we can do that early on, we maybe not have the same issues that we have now with some of our teenagers about making decisions and dealing with peer pressure.
Okay, so I'm going to be the devil's advocate then. So we make that deal with Susie, and she decides, I'm not going to do my homework. I'm just going to take my chances tomorrow. I'll do it at recess, right? And so she doesn't turn it in, and as a parent, we're like, oh, too bad, Susie. You're going to get zeros on this. But then I get the phone call from the teacher saying, Mrs. Barrett, you know, why aren't you helping Susie succeed? Because, you know, we have that test coming up in May and we need to get our scores up. So is it then my responsibility as a parent to step in, or do I turn to the school and say, I'm not so worried about it. I want Susie to fly or fail. And then now that goes into my parenting chart, right? Because the schools keep these charts about what kind of parents we are. It's not, and I know this, it's not just about what our children are like, but your parental behavior follows your child throughout school, whether or not you are a compliant parent or not. So again, I worry for my parents because I'm worried about our children being overdiagnosed in labels, but I worry all the way down to the minor details of how do we as parents hold our ground and say, look, my children are going to fail or succeed on their own in elementary school, so they're ready for fail or succeed in high school, and the school is going to have to deal with it. How will my child then be received at school if they are if I am perceived as a resistant parent?
Yeah, I don't think it's about being resistant. It's about being understanding your own child. And I always have a saying is, you know, it's more important to know who our kids are and their temperament versus where they are. And, you know, and the other thing I was just thinking about it is that, you know, teachers are saying, hey, you know, you need to help your kid read 30 minutes a day and do that. Well, we don't ask teachers to, hey, could you show Susie how to make her bed or clean up her room? So I still believe that with our support, we need to put that responsibility back on the student, back on the kid, and with our support and encouragement, and keep on asking the important questions about, you know, what do you need to do differently if you're not doing well in math? How can you, what are some of the ideas that you have? And if they don't have any ideas, if the child doesn't have any ideas about what to do, then, you know, we'll how about trying some of these things? How about talking with your teacher? How about staying in after school? Those kinds of things.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, 805-781-3875 to get your voice heard. And Michelle Gordon and Bill Spencer are my guests today from the Parent Connection. And so, Michelle, what say you on this?
Well, as an early childhood advocate, I certainly have to chime in, and I really appreciate Bill's suggestions in terms of looking at the situation as an opportunity to build skills. So in that conversation he was having as a parent, I heard that he was focused on some choice making with responsibility, that there was support for self-direction in that, that he was giving an autonomy. So I think being mindful of bigger picture and where are we going with this? Like what's our greater purpose in parenting? And so that's one element. And the other is really to understand developmental progression. So certainly the conversation around supporting your child to come up with a set homework time is appropriate at a particular age, and then pulling back is certainly appropriate during the teen years. But then in terms of the early years, in terms of our first 3 years, I just want to be really clear about reading to our children is essential. So what we're talking about the first 3 years is very different than what we're talking about during the school years is very different than the teenage conversation. So there is this developmental progression. So read a whole lot to your children when they're young in their first, you know, 5 years of life, and then give them the skills to have more autonomy.
Well, and I agree because I don't want to diminish the reading. And the only reason I said that is because, again, the pressure from the schools to do the work, basically. One of the greatest joys of my parenting years is reading to my girls all the way through junior high, because when they started to get kind of quiet and distant, sitting in the room reading stories to them was a way we stayed connected. I read the entire Harry Potter series with my daughter Kelly, and it took us, you know, 7 years, and it was heartbreaking when it was done because I wanted to read all the way through high school to her. So yes, I mean, I'm not talking about not reading to her children, but what I'm really trying to talk about is what is the responsibility for we as parents? How do we develop and grow? Because we talk about child developmental progression. Then I just want to say that I think the biggest priority parents should have when they're pregnant or actually when their children are born, a great way for moms and dads to get some time away from the kids, is take a developmental child developmental class at your local junior college when your children are young. It can be a date night, because that is how we learn to parent. That saved me when my children were young, because no one teaches you post baby raising what you can expect from children. And if you want to have the power in raising your children, you have to understand developmentally what they're capable of. So take that class. And then again, how do we grow as parents? Because I do want to address, for some of this hour, those teen years of how do we normalize the teen storm and not freak out and fear? Because if we fear our child is going to commit suicide or run away or become a drug addict, if we tell them no, then we're setting that child up to run away, become a drug addict, and commit suicide. I mean, it's counterintuitive, because a lot of our fear-based parenting actually sets our kids up for a lot of those risky behaviors. 805-781-3875. Hi, Becky, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, I appreciate your subject today. I'm a parent of a 26-year-old and a 15-year-old. The 15-year-old does have ADHD, and we have gone through the labeling and the medication and things, but I really wanted to say that, you know, my son is no longer on medication, and he actually chose when to go off of it, and it was, you know, between junior high and high school. And, you know, there's still the struggle. He's not on medication. He's in high school, and there's that huge jump from going, well, and in from sixth grade to with more teachers that you're working with, and how hard that is to make sure they're all on the same page. We've had excellent support through San Luis Coastal and Baywood Elementary, and I don't know what we would have done without them, but being vocal as a parent and just being in there, you don't want to be too pushy, but you also do want to let them know that your child is struggling and there's a reason they're not paying attention in class or getting things turned in. One thing a parent might do is we were able to have his homework be unfinished classwork in elementary school and in junior high, and that might be something for parents to consider asking for.
Well, I love, Becky, that you talk about the adapting piece, because, you know, with your son's diagnosis, or, you know, or if he was diagnosed, or, you know, no matter what, the job of understanding our children's temperament is so much of what Bill's talking about. We're talking about today is that you as a mom mm-hmm. have found out what your son has been capable of and helped him use his strengths, right, and adapt his challenges to be able to be successful. And isn't that really all we can ask?
Yes, and, you know, I do want to say, too, just even in high school, I talk with the teachers, like, sports and music are huge assets, you know, that he has, and we choose, you know, does he get a higher grade in class and spend hours and hours and hours doing homework, or does he go out and excel at wrestling or at, you know, being in band and things like that, and it's, you have to weigh it, and then, you know, there is pressure from some teachers are like, you know, if you're not doing good now, how are you going to get into college? Well, when they're 15 and they can't, yeah, it's a balance and it's a struggle, because you do want your child to succeed and go to college, but that may not be the plan. There may be something different.
Absolutely. Becky, thank you for calling in. And I think that's a really good point, is the whole next hour that we get to have a conversation is how do we redefine what success looks like for our children so that we're not setting them up to deal with depression and anxiety, right? How do we minimize the cultural pressures that are setting our children up for having these mental health issues? Because, you know, we can argue all day long about the biological nature of it, but if you peel back much of our children's and our own behaviors, you will find a social, cultural reason why we're struggling. Did you want to add something, Michelle?
I really appreciate when you said, you know, looking at how we define success. I know I've sort of alluded to my own personal lessons as a mom, and I think that was something for me I had to really rethink. I'm an educator, my husband's an educator, and, you know, with our children, we were on a straight path to college, but that wasn't necessarily the path for my youngest, and some amazing things have come out of that, and it's really allowed me to think of in different terms of how do we support our children and support their strengths and amplify their strengths and what resonates with them.
My guiding mantra for parents and clients and my students at Cal Poly is always, you know, before you jump on the bandwagon that you are somehow sick or mentally ill or, you know, broken in some way, step back and question really what is the concern. Is it you? Or is it the culture or the goals or the society you're trying to fit into that is actually sick or not in your best interest? Because, again, we talk about how narrow the definition of success is, and that conveyor belt that we're sending kids up through childhood leaves very, very little room for alternative learning or alternative styles of behavior. Calvin, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thank you very much. The other night I went to see Michael Moore's latest film, a documentary at the Palm Theater. And in this film, he takes you to Finland and visits with the educators in Finland. And in Finland, they've had a tremendous turnaround in the results of their school system. They're the most successful in the world. And one of the things they did was to abolish homework. That seems a little counterintuitive, but that's what they did. Can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. What do you think, Bill? How does that resonate for you?
Well, as a former principal of a continuation school the students there didn't fit into the traditional style, I saw kids who were acting out, not doing well, very distracted. And then they came over to the continuation school where most of their work was done there. The homework was project-based, where it was really hands-on. And this really worked for the students. And even today, I'll see students that I had 25 years ago who were really struggling, went to continuation school, and then moved on and were able to be successful. In fact, a few of them have graduated from Cal Poly and have had very successful lives.
So what do we say? End the homework burden? Can we be done with homework?
I mean, that's interesting. And I think, again, that pressure. And sometimes the choices we make actually fly in the face of research, because my understanding of the research around elementary school homework is it does very little to move a child forward in terms of academic success. There's more correlation certainly in the high school years, but very little in the elementary school years. And I've seen too many families in tears at night without family dinner, without downtime, trying to manage the homework. And I think there certainly is a significant segment of our population who could get behind, if not getting rid of homework, certainly rethinking the truth about 10 minutes and 20 minutes, as Bill said, which has become an hour, 2 hours. And if you have a child with special needs, that becomes most of the night.
Well, and then, of course, ironically, you know, I look at just my two children and their experiences. I have one child who studied to keep up with the AP classes and really worked hard. And I sat up with her at night and read, because I wouldn't do homework with my children. I refuse. But I would stay up and keep them company and read and just be in the room. My second child, though, came through and I never saw her open a book. All 4 years and 72,000 AP classes later, never opened a book. And so I look back at both their education and going, really, you know, where did homework play in this? Because both of them had their own learning styles, they had their own temperaments, they had their own drives, and the homework really didn't help my older daughter get any further down the road, and my younger daughter never seemed to have it. So it feels, again, like it's not as helpful.
Yeah, I rarely did homework.
Yeah, there you go.
Even through college.
But of course, we're another era, too. Katya, what's on your mind?
Oh, I was just listening to the program, and my son was diagnosed at a very young age with ADD and anxiety disorder, because he couldn't sit down and do two problems of math without crying. It was so overwhelming to him. But I think what we found is the most successful is if you just communicate really clearly, both with the child and with the school, it's amazing what you can accomplish.
And how old is your son now?
He just started junior high, and it's been an interesting learning curve for us because part of the time, you know, he really wants to do it himself. But so he'll study for a test, completely fail it, and then we'll come back and we'll say, okay, no, you did it your way. How about we try studying again? You can try it our way. So letting him have those successes and failures, letting him go back and retake the test. And he ended his first semester with a 3.8. Wow. You know, he did really well because we let him explore, you know, how he thought he should do it. And then, okay, well, let's rethink this. No kid knows how to study once they hit junior high.
Right, all bets are off. No, Katya, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I commend you for having faith in your son that he was going to figure it out. So congratulations.
Right, that's what we're talking about, that balance of, you know, wanting our children to succeed in the traditional way, but that gut instinct saying, I have to follow what my child's temperament is and help them learn how to be the most successful. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Bruce, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, what my wife and I noticed is, I mean, let's face it, when you're in your 30s and 40s, you know, sometimes you're getting over your own childhood. You're dealing.
True.
So we were dealing with that, and we realized we weren't big disciplinarians. That was our weak point. So we had to sit down and have a conversation and say, well, these are our strengths and these are our weaknesses, and that was our weakness. So the way we kind of remedied it is we decided that we're not going to take our kid's side against a teacher or a coach.
Mm. That's kind of old school.
In any situation, basically. You know, like you said, the natural consequences of your actions in life. And so you want to be a starter on the team, play harder, practice more. You want to get better grade, study more. And this is what you need to do. You know, and our kids punish themselves emotionally. You know, when they messed up, they punish themselves emotionally. And we just let that, you know, take its course. And now we've got, you know, one with a master's degree, one at Cal Poly, one decided not to do college, but all three of them have come up to us at one time or another and told us they appreciated the fact that we didn't hammer them at the point that they were making their own mistakes in life.
I appreciate that, Bruce. And I think as parents, too, it takes a lot of courage to sit down and be able to examine, hey, what's working for my family and what's not and how do we adjust? And I think, you know, and I look back at my friends who I feel were most successful as parents were the ones who were the most not difficult on their kids, but the ones from a very early age said, hey, if you would like to have this, you know, a car when you get older or something fun when you're young, you will earn that. And so instead of giving things to their kids, they gave their children opportunities to earn money or taught them how to make things and taught them how to cook and take care of themselves. Like all of those practical skills for adulthood, they, instead of spending time pushing their kids, you know, in sports or pushing them on activities or taking them to Disneyland or, you know, all these things that have become kind of de facto parenting things that we're supposed to be doing, even things like trips to Europe or, you know, these parents focused on getting their kids prepared for adulthood. And both of these young men went to college and paid their own way and in adulthood now are traveling and exposing themselves to, you know, adventures and challenges. And so I think back on what our goals and our job is as parents, it really comes down to, it's not about making our children perfect or helping them, you know, get the highest degree or make the most money. Our job as parents is to help our children find ways that they can be successful, whatever that is for them, and also to teach them the skills of adulthood. And quite often it's because parents haven't learned the skills of adulthood themselves that prevents them from helping their children to succeed. And so I really want to encourage all of my listeners out there to do your work in helping your children to find what it is they want and to work towards it and to support that and teach them the basic skills. Teach them how to change oil in a car, how to make a meal, because that's going to help them be the most successful. The Parent Connection, if people want more information, Michelle, how do they find out?
You can go online, Slow Parents, SLO Parents with an S.org. We also have a main line, 805 543 3700. So that's how you get hold of Parent Connection. Again, parent coaching is no cost. We have a parent coach who's bilingual in the South County, a parent coach in SLO, and one in the North County. And we're happy to meet with you and talk more about these ideas from today.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Bill. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX.